I'm Larry, I'm an alcoholic, and by the grace of God, I'm sober today, and God, this is a hard group to follow up here, and what a great gift this is to be sober and to be able to come and share my story. These guys know how to do it if I know all three of them, and it's interesting because I've had one of those days I had to start over a bunch of times, and I've learned in here that if you're having a rotten day, just start it over, so I have to do that, and then I went and had dinner with John and listened to him for an hour, and that was very pleasant. And and then to hear Hank. Hank used to go to a meeting that I helped start with another drunk called Survive and Serve, which was at the Holy Cross Hospital. And I think it's still going. I don't know. But he buckled up and went in there. It's at 1 o'clock in the afternoons, and it's still going. And we started that Survive and Serve for people that had alcohol-related accidents, not to other people, but to themselves, and it was pretty interesting how we'd have that meeting, and Hank was a big part of that, and it's been over 20 years now, I think. It's been going at least over 20. I know I was the treasurer and secretary there for about 6 months, about 6 years, I think. God, it bought me a brand new home out in West Valley, and I just really wouldn't give it up, you know? We could never give AD service work because nobody'd stay sober, but I know... there was a treatment center for women, and that's the only one they'd let them go to, because if they went to other ones, they'd get beat up from an ex-husband that was there or something, and so they felt really safe in there, and this is a gift you get from sobriety, was I'm going to bounce all over tonight, I'm a drunk, I'm an alcoholic, addict, anything I can get in my system. I got sober when I was 31, I haven't found it necessary to go back out. And I know it's only by the grace of God in this program, working this program. A couple of things he touched on was service work for me. When I first got sober, I don't like to be a central office or all this other bullshit. I put all my direction into making coffee, cleaning ashtrays. I hate central office, so I'm not really a big part of there. I think they do a great job, but I'm not part of that, and because I'm too much of a fucking control freak. And I'm also a perfectionist. And that was when I did my first four-step, my first sponsor pointed that out very delicately, that you're a fucking perfectionist. So, when I got sober, whenever I hear a chapter when we talk about, you know, we tried to do this, tried to do that, quit drinking, I never tried to stop. You know, it was a big part of me. I just like getting high. You know, I was in Park City. I drank. That's where my running and gunning days were. I guess I can go back since it's an hour and a half meeting. I grew up as a poor white boy on the west side of Salt Lake. And I came from Italian parents. My mother was very short. And she's probably shorter now. She's been dead 30 years. But and my dad was, my mother was like 43 when she had me. Okay, that's the problem there. And when I was 30, when I was 20, my dad was 60. So I grew up with these two old people. But it was pretty cool. And I had three brothers, but they were like 20, 30 years older than me. So I never really knew them, you know. I mean, my oldest brother just passed away. He was 86. I didn't even go to the funeral because I didn't even know him that well. But anyway, so I grew up in a, you know, my dad was very emotionally never there because he was an alcoholic, and he quit on his own. He had raised my three older brothers, saw how alcoholism was, many times my brothers would come in and he'd be on top of my mother, beating her almost to death, and they'd have to pull her off, and you know, all that shit that goes along with alcoholism, but I never saw that. But what I did see was a man that was just totally miserable. You know, she said, either you quit drinking or you leave, or you're not going to have us anymore, and so she quit drinking. And it was really experienced to say, I couldn't figure out why he was so emotionally shut down all the time. And, you know, we always had big dinners, and every time I had something I wanted to talk about, she told me to eat first and we'd talk later. So I was very large growing up. And, Mom, how come that? Well, here, eat this first and we'll have some more spaghetti or meatballs or whatever. Like, oh, my God, you know. And So that's how I kind of grew up. And, you know, my dad did the right thing. You know, they put a roof over my head and fed me, and that was it. But I couldn't wait to get away from them. And I did a stint in the Army for about 6 months and got a medical discharge because I was a homosexual. And I didn't know that until I got in there. And, you know, fuck. You know, and this... I couldn't figure out why the doctor was due to give me an examination. And it was not right. It was not right. But no, I got drafted. I went in the Army like 71. That was not, I mean, I manipulated my way out of that shit. So if there's anybody here that's a veteran, you know, my total respect for you, you know, honestly. But, you know, I mean, I'm an alcoholic and I don't take orders from anybody, you know. And so I got out of that and then I lost 125 pounds. And I went from this overly large, fat Italian kid with big tits. Because I used to ask my mom, I used to say, what's a queer? She goes, oh, a queer is somebody that has big lips and they grow tits. And I went, oh, my God. So most of my life I worried about my tits growing. But this is what we do, okay? You have to get all this shit out, you know? So if I'm offending anybody, fuck you. And... But anyway, so I got out and I was like, you know, I'm looking pretty good, you know, I'm pretty hot, you know, and I started dating this woman who was kind of pushed on me, and she's a beautiful Greek woman, and we used to call her Jugs. She had like a, you know, really, she's beautiful, 24-inch waist and very large breasts, and we started drinking a little wine and smoking a little dope, and the next thing I know, she says, I'm pregnant, and I go, yeah, right, so... Anyway, got married, we had a couple kids, and I remember when she wanted to move, this is when the lying and the deceiving started was, she told me, we got to move in together, and I says, I can't, and she goes, why? And I says, I'm dying of something, and she goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I couldn't tell her no, I mean, you know, so we got married, and we had two beautiful children. Second time, I think it was the mailman, but he looks all like me, and... But I start that because that's how I was always a perfectionist. I had to have people like me. I couldn't ever be me. You know, I had to be better than everybody else. And I think not only because I'm gay, but I think because a lot of alcoholics are that way. I mean, we have to be perfect, and that's really a scary place to be. And when I first did my fourth step, the process of going from being perfect to not being perfect is very painful. Because you have to take risks. You have to say stuff like, no, you know, or I don't know, or I need some help. So anyway, I married her for a while. We were married about 3 or 4 years, and I had a clothing store, and I was in the clothing manufacturing business. I was 19 years old when I started. And I did that for about 5 years while we were married, and I would just travel all over and pack my nose and drink and do many Quaaludes. And I'm sure there's no one here, a lot of old-timers might know what Quaaludes are. But they were really handy because you could do a lot of cocaine and other type of stimulants and then do a Quaalude and you would just feel so good. And then you could start doing it all over again. And you could do that for 2 or 3 days. And people were dying all the time around us. And we'd go, oh, he's dead. What do you do? Quaaludes? Yeah, no big deal. But so I went from that, and then the drinking, I dried up for a while and I became a long-distance runner. And I was also studying to be an Episcopal priest during that time I was married. Because I thought Jesus would take away my... Nothing against Jesus. I think he's a great guy. And I am Christian. I believe in him. But I thought he would take away the gayness in my life. And I could be a respectable parent. Which I wanted to... You know, I mean, most of us back then. You got married because you can't be Italian and gay. So... But it was just really painful shit. And when I finally... When I got divorced from her, I moved to Park City. And that's when I really flamed out. And... Literally, I used to call everybody honey. Oh, honey. And they go, oh, God, what are you doing now, you know? And I was, fuck, you know. And everybody kissed my ass because I was building all these fancy resorts up in Park City. And, you know, and just packing my nose and running and gunning. I loved it, you know. And this went on for about 4 years. And about a year before I got sober in 86, we had this huge party. And I had these investors in town. And we were throwing this big Christmas party. And I was still kind of in the closet, I guess, and I had this beautiful, I was thinking about this morning, I was doing my walk, and I was thinking about, she was this beautiful woman, and she had these big, beautiful red lips. She was my secretary, and she's just really a gorgeous woman, and she was going to be my date that night. So we made sure she had a beautiful evening gown, and I had this tuxedo that was all, you know, very fancy and shit, and we get there, and it was going to be a big deal. And by then, if I was going to go have fun, I had to be half-loaded. I mean, it just got to that, you know. One or two cocktails, and then there were five cocktails, and then there were 10 to even get a buzz on to get where you were going to go. And so anyway, we went to this party, and it was a fancy schmancy place. Deer Valley wasn't even built yet, but it was one of the fancier places up there, and I was really loaded. And I was doing, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but cocaine's a big part of my deal, and they used to cut cocaine with baby laxative. I don't, you know, if you're still doing blow, make sure it's cut with something different. So anyway, I know, Hank. Anyway, so I go to this fancy smancy party, and I'm out there being Mr. fucking Big Shot, and I thought I kind of had a little gas going on or whatever, you know? And I basically crapped my pants. And I got, there's a full room of people. I got like $20,000, $30,000 of the cash. I'm throwing it out, and I'm giving all the little kids are running up, and my date comes around, and she's, oh my God, you shit your pants. Oh, really? Wow. So that was kind of the start of hitting bottom, and I really believe that an old friend of mine, Nancy, I used to love her, Nancy, and some of the old timers like Sean and some of them might remember her, but Lombard, Nancy Lombard, she was in Park City where I got sober, and she'd go to meetings and hear these old farts that would say, I drank for 30 years, you know, and rah, 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 rah. And she goes, you're so full of shit. Your life hasn't been miserable for 30 years. It's only been miserable about the last year or so. Because that's how it was for me. Alcoholism and drugs just quit working. It just got so bad, you know. And it's like this domino, you know. I had these investors that were paying all kinds of money to build this stuff up there. They kind of told me to hit the road because of the shit in your pants routine. Doesn't work very well. And God, they couldn't, you know, they were just so serious about everything. Anyway, you know, I had a hotel, the Radisson Hotel, under contract, which was going to be part mine. I had the bar. Of course, this is an alcoholic. I made sure that I had the lease on the bar. That was going to be mine for 30 years. And I just basically blew all that away because of my drinking and drugging. And I know alcoholics like to hear about material shit, you know, because that's really important to us because we all want money. And so that was a big thing, but I kind of lost all of that. And then I was dating this person that told me I was an alcoholic, and that pissed me off. And then, you know, just to a point, I wasn't working. They gave me a bunch of money. I had severance, you know, they gave me a huge severance package. And I was just going to kind of screw off. And I could not quit drinking and drugging for like a month. Just constantly, constantly drinking and drugging. But looking good doing this. And there used to be a bar called the Studebakers. And I went down to have a couple cocktails. And luckily, I wasn't doing cocaine that night, but I had a couple cocktails. And then I used to go down to the really trashy gay bars. And some of you know where those are. Stand up, people like stand up. Anyway, you know, things really changed. Because when I used to speak 20 years ago, I'd say, oh, there's some of my gay friends. I'll go like this, you know. They're going to be outed, but now they just go, hi, whatever. So things are changing a little bit in that area. But anyway, so I remember I just bought this new Lincoln Town car. I always had big cars. It was like, still have big cars. Anyway, I was pulling out, and the last thing I remember, I blacked out and I left the bar. And I woke up about 2 weeks later in a hospital. And I was paralyzed on my left side, couldn't see out of my left eye, I couldn't talk, I couldn't sit up, I couldn't do anything, I was totally paralyzed and just a fucking vegetable. And I even had the drilling going on, which was really cool. And what had happened was I drank so much that night that I went down to one of the bars and I saw this friend I broke up with, and I wasn't really a mean person, but I just kind of pushed him, and he just kind of come back and give me a quick one. And I hit my head on the ground, knocked my head out, and the paramedics came and got me, and they drove around because I had acute alcohol poisoning, which is basically I had no vitals at all going on, so they pronounced me dead. Well, these ambulance people, they drove me around for looking for a hospital to take me because they heard I was gay and they knew this thing called AIDS, so they were worried that the hospital would be infected. So they finally took me to Holy Cross Hospital and put me in a cooler, stripped me down, put the tag on my toe and closed the thing behind me, and they called my business partner at the time, who was also alcoholic, and he was like two months away from being a medical doctor, but it was more important to raise cattle. And that's a whole other deal there. And so he went and raised his cow. Anyway, yeah, we're going to make a lot of money there, weren't we? Anyway, so he comes over and he goes, this guy is like loaded. He says, I know how much he drinks. He is not dead. He is loaded. So they took me upstairs, and they started pumping up a bunch of shit. And it's funny because people just say, did you have an out-of-body experience? I says, yeah, I did. I had this feeling I was in this silver thing, and everything was really silver and beautiful. It's like, yeah, I was in the goddamn cooler. I was coming out of my black out of the cooler. You know, there's enough people out there you can say, oh, they go, oh, that's so spiritual. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, so when I started coming out of it about 3 days into it, they decided, since I was having a conversation, talked to everybody, and I finally told my brother, and I says, who the hell are you? You know? They knew there was a problem, so they said either operate on him or it'll be if we don't operate on him, he'll die, and if we do operate, it'll be a vegetable. We're going to do it. And they, oh, we need a vegetable. We'll keep him alive. So about a month later, I started coming out of this coma, and I'm laying there going, Jesus, Horton, you just really, Roy Horton's my last name. And they just says, you really did a number on yourself here. You know, I says, God, how could I do this? How could I be so stupid to do this shit? You know, talk about beating myself up. And I had this Episcopal priest that would come in all the time that I actually was going to train under, and he'd come in and he gave me last rites all for like 2 weeks. And then he came in and gave me communion every day, which was just some shitty water or something. I don't know. I wish it had been wine. But he gave me that. And it turned out later that the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese here was very active in AA, who opened up the churches to all of us. He had like 40 years of sobriety when he died. And this was part of what he did. And the priest that I had, who also was in the program, who had a son that was gay, who attempted suicide many, many times, had come out, and he was also been sober for a while in AA. And this guy was put in my life. I really believe that, messengers just appear for us. I think alcoholics are really lucky that way. I think there's people, angels, we're going to call them. They just kind of come into our lives. And I had so many that happened, that came into my life. I just kind of blew off because I was in such denial about being an alcoholic. But as you get sober, I remember those people and how important they were in my life to help me get sober, to make me realize that I did have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And so I went through 5 months of rehab, Holy Cross Hospital, started walking and talking. The day they were leaving, when I was getting out of the hospital, I was in the wheelchair. I was sitting there, and I still had, my head was shaved off, had a patch over my eye, and I looked pretty rough. And he just walked over, he just came over, and he says, this priest says, who the hell do you think you are? I says, why? And he goes, you are so judging yourself so bad. He says, God would never judge you that way. Your higher power would never judge you that way. He says, you've got to forgive yourself. And that was actually the beginning of my recovery right then. I call it a quick ninth step, He taught me how to forgive myself. And I've always had, I've been blessed with, I love to laugh. I think laughing is a spiritual thing of what we do. That's how we heal in here. We laugh at each other. We laugh with each other. And that's what works because, I wanted to be sober, but I didn't want to be some old, I didn't want to be a dry drunk like my old man. I look back now, and I remember when I first came into AA, the first man I went to was a step meeting. And I've gone pretty regularly. I think I've probably gone at least a step meeting a week for the last almost over 23 years. And I really believe in the steps. They changed my life. The first year I got in there, I didn't know what the steps were. I didn't know what the big book was. Sometimes I think sometimes we're so complicated. I don't like to hear people that they're told, newcomers, you have to do this and this and this and this and this. You know, if you're a newcomer, just hang around the rooms, you know, and let your body heal. I was taught that we have a spiritual, physical, and emotional recovery. I was taught that I couldn't put all this shit down. You know, when I was recovering from the head trauma, a lot of it was from just the abuse of drugs and alcohol for, you know, 3 or 4 years. My body was healing off that. And one of the first sponsors I had, her name was Jo, and she never told me how much time she had. She had 40-something years. But she never told me how much time she had. And it was just really good to know her. I mean, she taught me some really good stuff, and I really miss her, and I respect her. And then she fired me. And what a bitch. Anyway, and it's weird. She died of emphysema, too. She couldn't get off the smokes. She used to move the mask out of the way. Yeah, fucking blow us all up. She had this smoker's voice. She goes, why don't you go fuck yourself? She was a mountain woman, and she was very beautiful, and she had black hair, and she was very elegant until she opened her mouth. And then, but anyway, you know, I get up here and I talk about all the people that have been in my life. I mean, all this shit, I mean, I couldn't have done any of this. This is stuff that was taught to me. And so I got involved, and here I am on the cane, and she had me going to Holy Cross Hospital to do service work. And I thought, why did I do this? You know, look at me, I'm a mess. I got the cane, I can't walk, and couldn't drive the car. I was having seizures, which I did drive the car. And she'd say, oh, are you feeling sorry for yourself today? I go, God, yeah, well, maybe, you know. I'm walking around, look at me, you know. And so I drive down to Holy Cross Hospital, and I get in there, and this one nun, there's all these nuns in there at the time. And I love nuns. I like to watch them move. They're really fast. And she says, oh, you're Joe's. Yeah, come on, I got some work for you to do. And we're going to buy you lunch, too. And that was really good because I was really broke. And so what I do is I went in there, and she says, you're going to go see patient number blah, blah, blah. And I went in there, and there's this guy in there, and they had, like, cut fingers off, part of his leg off. And you're going to take him down into these tubs, which we do for people that are dying of diabetes. It's okay. So I push whoever it was down, and I'm like on the cane, and I'm really struggling. And, you know, and I take it down going, God, this is really great. This is really going to help me, you know. And I go down there, and then the nurses would help me, put them in these big things. We'd haul them in these tubs, these whirlpool tubs, and they would just spin the circulation to get them circulating. And I'm going, God, this is really helpful. And I start talking to these guys that were all dying from this disease and how many times they tried to stop and how they wanted to stop for the wife, they wanted to stop for the daughter, the son, the husband, whatever. And then after we'd pull them out of the tub, they'd made me clean the tub. So I'd haul him back up to the room and then you later, whatever. And I'd go back down, hobble around and clean the tub. You know, wash it down and shit. Now, I'm not a well man here, right? And I used to get so mad at her, and I did it like once a week, and it made me heal so much faster because someone's always worse, you know? Someone's always worse. And, you know, I tell the stories because most alcoholics, like I got on this little circuit thing, and we had all these people that had done problems to themselves, and we went and talked to high schools. And I had this friend of mine who had a shotgun in her mouth, and she blew half her face off, and she'd go. I had another guy that was in a car accident. He had two guys in front of him, three guys in back, and he was driving. He hit a wall going about 110 miles an hour. And all I remember was all their bodies exploding over him and going into the car, and he survived this. And he was really not all there. He just wore underwear all the time. This is really weird. And T-shirt and underwear, and we'd just go to these talks, and then see this guy looking BBD sign, you know?
Wow.
I mean, we had attempted suicides and shit, and we'd all sit in there, and we'd all tell our stories, and everybody, I know all the non-alcoholic people that don't have alcohol, these young kids in high schools would go, oh my God, so sad, you know? And all the alcoholics, you could just pick them out, because they'd be going, boy, they really got some bad luck. These guys have got bad luck. I'll tell them, that'll never happen to this. I'll just keep snorting and drinking. It'll never happen to me. So after doing this for about a year, I realized it really wasn't going to work very well for alcoholics. And, you know, and then, of course, it probably saved a few people, but we quit doing that. But and then we went from there. And then when I started going to meetings, I loved meetings. I'd go in there and say, "Who's making coffee?" And they'd say, "Well, you're making coffee." You know, cleaning up ashtrays, and I got sober in Park City, and I used to come to meetings down here. There's an old fellowship hall, and I'd all be wearing overalls, and it was like the thing to do when you got 20 years, you wore overalls. Really? And they'd all sit around, play cards, and smoke 5 packs of cigarettes. That's what I want. I want to be like them and wear overalls. And, you know, being the fashion-conscious guy I am, I didn't like to go to those meetings, but my sponsor made me go there. But after about the first year, I guess where I'm going with this is I was speaking on another it was a head trauma thing I was speaking for, and this woman in the meeting, I met this woman, this friend of mine, and she her son had been in stole a car one night. They were drunk. There was like 14, and they rolled the car, and it killed a couple of kids, and the car rolled over his head, and he was just never the same. Obviously, when the car rolls over your head, you kind of get dingy. And but he was never the same, and her name was Linda S., and she was very wealthy. I mean, this woman was so full of money. But she was really tight, too. And if you've ever been around people that come from money, they're pretty tight. And but we got to be really good friends, and I helped her through this process. And she had this therapist that used to fly in, and her name was Belle Mashinsky. And she had the same voice as Belle. She smoked a lot of cigarettes. She had a terrible smoking voice. And after this, she walked over and she goes, "Do you know Bill W?" And I went, "No, who's Bill W?" I've been going to meetings for 6 months. I said, "No, who's Bill W?" She goes, "Have you heard of AA?" I says, "Oh, yeah." I go, I'm big in AA. God, yeah. I know. God, I'm helping everybody. I'm saving the world here, you know. You know, 6 months sober, I can save anybody. You know. Read the big book? Huh? "Oh, yeah, I go to step meetings." "No, do you read the big book?" I says, "Yeah, I've kicked it around a little bit." And she was so loving and kind and caring, and she had this aura about it I wanted. There was just something about this woman. She had lived on the streets in San Diego. Her family had abandoned her. She got sober, and her sponsor, which I didn't know till I was about 10 years sober that her sponsor was my grand sponsor, was Dr. Paul from the big book. And he almost got kicked out of AA because he talked about Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and everybody hated him who was in AA, like the old timers, like this Clancy dude, whatever. Yeah. And excuse me. Anyway, she taught me so much. And at this point now, you know, having 6 months to a year, I didn't have any money. I had no insurance. I was living in I had this little condo in Deer Valley, the west side of Deer Valley. And I always say that because I'm from the west side. Shit, you can't get that west side shit out of me. But I couldn't afford the payment. It was a huge payment. It was $575 a month. And that was a huge payment you're only making. And so I had to move out of it. And so I moved into a little two-bedroom place, was living there, and I like the way the program works because back then we used to help each other a lot, and I didn't have any furniture. I had to leave it in there. And I went to a meeting once. There was this lady, and I used to always love her. I used to talk to her, and she just struggled so much, you know, and she almost got killed in a balloon riding thing. They had balloons up there one time, and she let the air out too quick and crashed. And anyway, she was fucked up. She was drunk. And she used to tell this story at every meeting. Let the air out too fast, and I went down, and you know, those balloons are not fun when there's no air, you know. And she said, so I went to a meeting, and I was feeling so bad because I didn't have a bed to sleep in. And then you hear the other guy, they hear people say, "Well, I slept on the floor for 2 years of my sobriety." I mean, I don't give a shit how you slept. I don't have a bed. She came up to me and she says, "You know, I bought this bed a couple months ago. I don't know why I bought it. You want it?" I says, "Yeah." I was like, "I got a bed." And I'd sleep in a bed. But, I mean, that's just how it used to work. We used to take care of each other. You know, if you needed a couch, you'd share it with me. I need a couch. And, God, you'd have, like, five couches the next day. And nice ones, too. They were nice. And but that's how it kind of worked. And anyway, I'm really jumping around here tonight because, I mean, when you get some time in this program, I mean, I've been touched by... I know there's a higher power. I know there's a God. I have no problem with that. I've been through shit. I've been through good times. I remember old Mason Rankin, who was influential in AA meetings, and he used to say, I walked in one day, and I was feeling really good. I had about a year, and I walked in, I go, hey, how you doing? How you doing? And he goes, well, looks like you need to work on your grandiose behavior. What, you can't have fun in AA? Grandiose behavior! And I was so pissed off at him. I used to live like that because if you went to a meeting and you talked about anything and they didn't want to talk about, they'd throw big books at you. I mean, literally. And they were always the big, heavy-set lesbians that I didn't like. And, I know, fuck you too. And but I love these women because they were just, they were AA, why are we talking about AA Nazis? They were just, they'd been through worse shit than I'd been through, and they were staying sober. And they'd say, go home and read page, and I'd go, no, and I'd go home and read it just out of spite, and the next day, oh, come here, oh, I love you. Oh, it helped me so much. So it was really good. I mean, you know, and they're all dead now anyway, so. And then, so that was good. I wish we still did that, you know, because if you eat somebody after me and you go, have you eaten? And you'd say, and they go, fuck you, I'm not going to read that shit. I don't want to read it. You know, like I went to a party last night, and I shared this earlier today, but there was a lady there. She had 27 years of sobriety and quit going to meetings, like a couple years ago. And she wasn't drinking, but she like cornered me and my boyfriend for like 20 minutes on why she was justifying why she didn't have to go anymore. And it's just like, God, I just want to put my hand up and get away from me. You know, I don't need to hear this shit. You've been sober long enough to know. I had one of my sponsorees, 5 years sober, and he's very intelligent. I mean, the guy writes a couple newspapers for the Israeli generals and all this kind of shit. He's very intelligent. And he, for 5 years, he had to prove this program. He was smarter than this program for 5 years. And he just went back out about 6 months ago. And the last year of his sobriety, he didn't have a job. He worked the program. He went to meetings. He took everybody's inventory. He could tell anybody he wanted to in the meeting, but he couldn't take his own inventory. He couldn't look at himself to see what's going on with him. And I remember the first time he did a fourth and a fifth step with me. But he had 5 years, and he started drinking. And it was so funny because I have caught so many of my sponsorees drinking or drugging. I mean, it just happens. God just puts me in. Like, I hired this guy one time who was doing a remodel, who was sober. And I got home, and I had about 10 years of sobriety. And I got home, and I thought, something's not right. So I went upstairs, and I used to, you know, being a little grandiose, I'd buy gold in Mexico, just jewelry and shit, you know. And I... Whatever. I didn't. Tony wears it. I don't wear it. See, when you're alcoholic, you go through different shit. Like, you know, you buy not one house is enough, but 10's plenty. Or you don't plant one tree in your yard, you plant 20 trees in your yard. Or you don't have one Tiffany lamp, you buy 20 Tiffany lamps. Or you don't have one car, you have 3 cars. So that's the shit you work on as you get sober, and it's really a lot of fun. And you can break yourself doing that. And anyway, so. I just totally went outdoors on that one.
The remodel,
there we go. So I go up there and all my jewelry is gone. It was just chains and shit, you know. And so I'm going, what the hell? And I'm going, oh, I wonder where he is. He was out to lunch. Yeah, right, you know. So I'm driving down the street. Just, it was like I was being directed there. And there he is standing on the street. He had cut up all the chains and was selling it to get some crack. And I pull up and I go, hi, what are you doing? And he just like, I mean, it was just so, and I says, you know what? I love you, and if you need any help, I'll be there for you. And I drove off, because he needed it more than I did. This guy with 5 years had a sponsor. He called me up. He says, are we going to work the stamps tonight? Well, I've had a really long day, and at 6 o'clock, I'm really tired. Well, we want to work. We're supposed to do some steps tonight. I said, okay, I'll drive down and meet you. This is how God uses us. I mean, I really believe that. He uses us. Once we get sober, he uses us all the time. And I'm so grateful for that. And so I'm driving down the street, and I'm going by the liquor store, and I see my sponsoree come walking out with a backpack. And so I pull over, and he's hitting on some woman who had also had a bike. They're probably both alcoholics, I'm sure. We ride bikes for a while. And I pull up, and he's talking to her, and I put my window down, and I go, "Hey, what's happening? Did you just come out of there?" He goes, "Yeah." He says, "How long has this been going?" I says, "A couple of months." And I just says, I says, "It's kind of weird I'd drive by and see you." And he goes, "That's how it is for you. It's always that way for you." And I says, "Yeah, it is." And he says, "You know what? I love you, buddy. I'm there for you. I don't care if you're drunk. I don't care if you're sober. I love you, and I'll help you if you need some help. Call me." And he's still out there running and gunning. That's what I was taught in here, to have compassion for all of us. You know, I mean, that could have been me. That could have been me drinking. I could leave here tonight. I probably have a pretty good chance of going home being sober tonight, but I could leave here. I could have something. Well, you know, I first got sober, I drank over not having my kids. And I used to worry that they would die. Something would happen to them because I would drink. And I was pointed out that you want one of them to die so you can drink. It's a weird disease. So I'm almost out of time, but I just want to let you know that if you are a newcomer, you know, you can have some fun in here, you know. And if you're sitting here wondering if you're an alcoholic, you probably are. You wouldn't be at a fucking meeting listening to some old guy, you know, blow smoke, you know. I mean, it's not that bad to be an alcoholic. I mean, it's a great life, you know. I don't have to use today. And it's not the drinking or drugging. It's how I think. It's the crazy shit in my head that's constantly going on. So it doesn't matter if you're an alcoholic, drug addict, whatever you are, it's your head, it's going on in your head, it's all in your head, and you know, you can do it if I can do it. And I really want to thank you for letting me share tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.